Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Madison's Notes, the official podcast of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I'm your host, Annika Nordquist. I'm so excited to welcome today's guest, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who's a professor of health policy at Stanford's School of Medicine. He's also a senior fellow at Stanford's Institute for Economic Policy Research, and he directs Stanford's Center for Demography and Economics of Health and Aging. He holds both an MD and a PhD in economics from Stanford University, and his research has been widely published in peer-reviewed publications. In addition to his academic work, he became one of the focal points of public policy debates surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2020, he co-authored the Great Barrington Declaration, a document signed by a large group of infectious disease epidemiologists and public health scientists, which pushed against lockdown policies. With no further ado, I hope you enjoy. Dr. Bhattacharya, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to have you on.
Nice to be here, Annika. Thanks for having me.
So to kick us off here, you are a medical expert. Your PhD is in economics. And one of the fundamental insights that economics brings is the idea of trade-offs, and that even a thing that does very good things can sometimes have very unexpected negative consequences. And to me, that seems like one of the insights that's really kind of guided your work in this space. So can you talk to me a little bit about how thinking of the world that way impacts or should impact the way we think about medicine?
Well, medicine at its heart involves trade-offs. Every single thing that you do in medicine involves some kind of trade-off. I think every doctor, every good doctor understands that intuitively, right? If you give a drug, it may have side effects. Then the key thing is that the beneficial effects of the drug outweigh the side effects for the particular patient. I have an MD, but I do research full-time with the economics. I found that the research training economics fit in very well with applications to medicine, because at its heart, medicine is just that. It's just trade-offs.
I want to talk a little bit about COVID and the policy response with that in mind. But first, I want to zoom out a little bit and ask a little bit about you, because you've had just sort of this crazy whirlwind of a role throughout this thing. What led you to care so deeply about these issues and about free speech in the medical sphere?
Well, the free speech aspect of it was a surprise to me. I always thought through my career that I lived and worked in an environment that valued free speech, like that kind of free speech led to productive disagreements. That's what I thought science and certainly a place like Stanford was devoted to. It was a very big surprise to me to realize that itself was called into question. Mm-hmm. I started in 2020, early 2020, with a hypothesis that the disease was more widespread than people realized. Mm. The reason I was led to that hypothesis, because I've been working in infectious disease epidemiology, infectious disease policy for a very long time. I'd seen what had happened during the H1N1 swine flu pandemic. And there, it was a surprise, I think, to many researchers and infectious disease folks that the disease was much more widespread than they had realized then. In 2009, there were these seroprevalence studies of antibodies in the population at large, measuring how many people had had the swine flu. And it turned out to be many, many more people than had been identified with the swine flu back then. And it changed. Like, when I read that literature, I was amazed. I was like, okay, wow, at public health, we're actually quite bad at measuring in real time how many people have the disease, because we focus so much on the people that have the symptoms of it that are very, very sick. And I had that same hypothesis early in this pandemic, that maybe because this is a so easily spread disease that there were a lot of people that had it that we didn't know about. There was that hypothesis. Then the other thing that led me into this was I do a lot of work on poverty and health, especially in poor countries. Mm-hmm. And so when I first heard about the lockdowns, my first reactions were as to the damage that these lockdowns were going to do to the poorest people of the world. Mm. It was very, very clear that people weren't adequately taking that into account in their thinking. And it's not just the poorest people in the poorest countries, but also the poor in this country, right? So I was thinking about what would happen to children that were abused, that you close schools down and now you don't have people to pick up the abuse, or domestic abuse for women. You lock them in houses with their abusers in lockdown. The impact of essentially ending work, well, it means that a lot of poor people are going to lose their jobs. They won't be able to feed their families. So I was thinking about all of those things in the early stages of the pandemic.
So it strikes me that, I mean, for the first one, the pushback would be, well, if everyone has it, then why aren't we taking it more seriously? Why wouldn't we want more lockdowns? And for the second one, I mean, I'm curious, A, how do you respond to the first pushback? But what kind of pushback would you get to that second point? Because it seems to me that for whatever reason, the right was way more concerned about that aspect of it than the left for reasons that I don't quite understand.
Okay, so on the first point about lockdowns, there are two separate questions in there, right? So the first question is, can lockdowns actually work?
Yeah.
Right? Is it a feasible strategy to actually suppress the spread of a disease? And I think that if you are naive about how our societies are actually structured, and you do not deeply understand how unequal our societies actually are, you may think that lockdowns are a feasible strategy. And I think a lot of people in public health, and especially in academic public health, they lead relatively privileged lives. They may say they understand the poor and they care for the poor. And I'm sure they do. The problem is that they don't really feel it. And you can see it in the earliest days of the pandemic. You could see public health officials blithely saying things like, well, stay home and stay safe, as if it were equally possible for everyone to do that.
Right.
If you spend any time in public health or in economics or health economics, you very, very quickly see how unequal our societies are. Mm-hmm. And that the kinds of things, so the social the social reality is that for some people, lockdown is impossible. Lockdown means starvation. You could see this most clearly, for instance, the early days of the pandemic in what happened in Peru, right? They had a draconian lockdown. It was the poor that faced starvation as a consequence. The World Health Organization, the World Food Program, they were saying this out loudly in the earliest days of the pandemic. They were saying that the lockdowns were going to cause 130 million people to starve. Mm. That was the projection. The World Bank was saying 100 million people are going to be thrown into poverty. The earliest seroprevalence studies in India, for instance, in Mumbai, found that the disease had spread to 70% of the population by July of 2020 in the Dharavi slums of Mumbai, but that in the richer parts of Mumbai, only 20%. Mm. In study after study in the earliest days of the pandemic, it was clear that the lockdowns were a luxury of the laptop class. I thought of it as trickle-down epidemiology. Mm-hmm. So the efficacy of the lockdowns really hinges on everyone having the capacity, the economic capacity to do this. And it was very clear that that was not the case, even from the very earliest days. I never thought of it as you could actually flatten the curve with the lockdowns because it didn't make any social sense. If you understood the social science literature at all, you'd know that that's not possible. So the fact that the disease is widespread, the question then in my mind was, and it still is, who are the people that are most vulnerable to these risks, and how can we devote resources to protecting those people? And it was clear from the epidemiological data, it was really an identifiable population. It was older people. That was true. You could see it in the data from the Diamond Princess cruise. You could see it from the Chinese mortality data from the early days of the pandemic. You knew it was the oldest people. So I didn't think that there was any contradiction. If it's fairly widespread, and it turned out in studies that I did early in the pandemic that like in April of 2020, 4% of LA County already had COVID, that had antibodies. What that meant is, A, that it's not zero. There was many, many people that had had COVID that public health didn't realize it had COVID. The disease was less deadly than people thought. It's still much more deadly than the flu, especially for the oldest people, but not so much for young people. It wasn't as big a threat for young people as the flu is. And third, that we're going to go to 100. This is the nature of these kinds of conditions, diseases that spread so easily, is that you're never at, you're, it's either you suppress it in its infancy at zero, or it's going to 100. It's 4% meant it's too late. It's already out of the barn. We're going to get to 100. The question is, how do we protect the population that's most vulnerable while the disease inevitably spreads, because you don't have a technology to stop it from spreading? So that was my thinking early on, that I wanted to know how deadly disease was. I wanted to know what the interventions that we use, the resources that we had to protect the most vulnerable, at the same time acknowledging that we didn't have a technology to stop it, to make it go away. Once the Pandora's box is open, it's open and you can't close it.
I wonder, I mean, the international perspective is very interesting to me, and that really is one of your specialties. And one of the kind of funny things about it is there was some variation in terms of how different countries responded, but broadly there were a lot of similarities. You've drawn attention to the similarities between our response and China's, which is sort of frightening conceptually. I wonder, I mean, there are a lot of areas where behavior, I mean, people imitate each other's behavior just essentially for status. I think the way that the universities handled COVID, it was a good example of this, where if one place was saying this is the vaccination requirement, you knew for sure once Harvard said it, Yale was going to make a similar announcement the next week. They're doing the same thing right now with test scores, for instance. As soon as one place says we're bringing it back, everyone else sort of feels like they have to too. Do you think that there was that sort of behavior happening on the international sphere when it came to COVID lockdown policy?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think it's explicit. This is a sort of Girardi and mimetic kind of idea that you brought
up. You picked up what I was putting down.
So I mean, I think that's actually quite insightful analysis. What happened was the Chinese lockdown in January 2020 led to first an evaluation by the WHO in February 2020. They sent a delegation, the WHO did, to China. That delegation came back convinced that the Chinese lockdown had worked, had gotten rid of COVID. And there's an email from Cliff Lane to Tony Fauci. Cliff Lane is Tony Fauci's deputy. Very early in the pandemic, right after he visits China and that delegation, where the email is to an epidemiologist in the World Health Organization saying, look, what China did worked, and we have very difficult choices to make. Mm-hmm. Right? They thought, based on the Chinese experience, that if we just lock down hard, we can get rid of the disease just like the Chinese did. Mm. That the nature of the disease, the spread of the disease was such that the lockdown could suppress it, and that in February, March 2020, the disease was still in its infancy, near zero. And a sharp, short lockdown might have a chance of getting rid of the disease. They were mistaken in their belief, but I think country after country copied that model, this draconian, totalitarian model of disease control, in the delusion that it would stop the disease from spreading. And there's this sort of protection in numbers, right? If Boris Johnson's doing it, then it's safe for Donald Trump to do it. Governor Gavin Newsom is doing it, well, then it's safe for other left wing governors to do it, right? It's like a lot of times people think of it as like left and right lockdowns. Mm-hmm. Anti-lockdown is right, and pro-lockdown is left, but actually that's not right. Mm-hmm. Like Sweden had a left wing government that was anti-lockdown. Boris Johnson's a right wing prime minister in the UK who's pro-lockdown, right? So you have it's basically a almost universal phenomenon where the politicians are copying other politicians, and there's safety in it. If they made a mistake, well, they made a mistake in the same direction everybody else. Who can blame them?
Right.
It's the Swedish response that needs an explanation, right? Mm. They actually followed what the standard public health guidance was. They stood up against the mob. Mm-hmm. And that's really surprising. They didn't fall prey to this sort of Girardi and Memesis kind of mechanism.
That's a really interesting. I mean, it strikes me as sort of unusual that everyone en masse would just abandon whatever the health, accumulated wisdom about how to deal with pandemics is. Do you have any insight into why that's the case? And I'm particularly interested, in previous interviews, you've talked about the fact that our public leaders were all alums of the HIV pandemic, and that connection is really interesting. I haven't seen it really discussed anywhere else.
Yeah, so I think this is multifaceted, but I think one of the answers to why we abandoned our basic standards for how we manage respiratory virus pandemics is that A lot of leaders didn't see this as simply just a public health threat, but essentially like a bioterror event.
Right.
A lot of the, you know, the military leaders were involved in, you know, for instance, the logistics around rolling out ventilators, mm-hmm. right? A lot of the discussion was classified. Like you can still see it, and when people try to FOIA the internal discussions about this, you get these FOIA'd emails back with basically everything redacted, even though a lot of it wasn't classified. So the thinking, I think, was that what if this is a bioterror event?
Mm.
Well, if it's a bioterror event, well then there are some plans for lockdowns in case of bioterror. Right, let's treat this. So, in addition to following the Chinese example, which convinced public health, you also have internally within governments this discussion, mm-hmm. where well, we should treat this like a bioterror event. The lockdown is part of the bioterror infrastructure. There's also like within the public health community, this notion of quarantining as an approach to managing the spread of diseases. Right, you mentioned HIV. Well, in HIV, a lot of the kind of instincts of public health were honed on the fight against HIV. A lot of the leaders in public health made their careers based on the fight against HIV. And there, what you had was you had public health adopt strategies to identify people who have HIV and isolate them from spreading the disease. In fact, there were explicit quarantines of HIV patients in some countries. Eventually, a lot of public health rejected it, just counseled people to reduce their sexual activity.
Right.
But there were the notion of contact tracing, of testing and tracing, mm-hmm. that's a very HIV idea. Works in HIV, actually. The idea of physical barriers to contact, you know, they're in a condom, in the case of COVID, a mask. Well, that's very common to HIV. The idea that there is no immunity in response to infection with HIV, which there isn't, right? The mm-hmm. HIV destroys your immune system. Well, that idea is imported into the epidemiology of COVID, even though it didn't have support in the scientific literature. The idea that that almost all of the damage from HIV is long HIV, AIDS is long HIV.
Right.
So you get mainly just asymptomatic spread and nothing else with HIV. Well, that idea was incorporated into the thinking around COVID. All of that divorced from the actual science of the virus itself, the way it operates, but the instincts that public health leaders honed from their fight against HIV, they brought into the COVID fight, and it was uniquely unsuited for that.
It's sort of amazing to me. I think people don't think enough about whether our medical system teaches the kind of flexibility of thought that would allow you to say, this one situation's like this, and this one's totally different, and we need to retrain our reflexes. I mean, would you agree with that? Is the issue kind of starting in the medical schools, or is this something that's more kind of a bureaucratic imposition?
Well, I think I say this as a medical educator, so I'm a little reluctant. I mean, I do know many brilliant students of mine that have that kind of flexibility of thinking.
Yeah.
But I think as a field as a whole, there is this worship of experts mm. that I think is quite unhealthy, right? So a lot of doctors, the way they think is, well, let's go find out what the expert guidelines say and let's just follow that.
Mm.
A lot of public health officials, they have this norm in the back of their heads, and they almost view it as like an ethical imperative mm. that you listen to what the high experts in the field say and you do not contradict them. Because just the act of contradicting what someone like Tony Fauci says must be dangerous ipso mm-hmm. facto for public health because he's an expert.
Right.
And I think that's quite dangerous.
So I want to move on to talking a little bit about the free speech issues that you've been involved with since the pandemic. And you've written or helped author this document, The Great Barrington Declaration. And you've called it the most important thing you've ever written, which strikes me as, you know, really incredible coming from someone who's, I mean, done a lot of really amazing technical work, that something like this, a declaration about free speech, would be the most important thing you've ever written. So what leads you to think that that is more important than all of the, you know, technical breakthroughs?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not that I'm against my own scientific work, but so the Great Barrington Declaration, I wrote it with Sunetra Gupta of Oxford. She's an amazing epidemiologist at Oxford University. And Martin Kulldorff of then of Harvard University in October of 2020. I still think it's the most important thing I've ever written, but it's also the least original thing I've ever written. Mm. It basically called for focused protection of vulnerable older people and lifting of lockdowns. I say it's the least original thing because it just reiterated what I understood to be the standard way we managed respiratory virus pandemics like the COVID pandemic that had worked for a century. The reason it was important, I believe, is that it shattered the illusion that there was a consensus in favor of lockdown, right? I mean, I normally don't really care all that much about, you know, the prestige of Stanford, Harvard, Oxford, or whatever, Princeton. But there you have Stanford, Harvard, Oxford epidemiologists and scientists saying, look, there is that we disagree with the lockdown paradigm, that there was another way and we should follow that other way. It sent a signal to the public at large that there was a scientific debate going on and that the press and the scientific bureaucrats were misrepresenting to the public the nature of that debate. Mm. In that, I think we succeeded, although we didn't actually change the strategy that we followed. We still had lockdowns in fall of 2020, alas. But the free speech aspects of that came out very, very quickly afterwards. What happened was the scientific bureaucrats, people like Francis Collins, the head of the National Institute of Health, 4 days after we wrote the declaration on October 8th, 2020, he wrote an email to Tony Fauci calling the three of us fringe epidemiologists, like an ad hominem slur, and then calling for a devastating takedown of the premises of the declaration. Hmm. What happened next was I started getting death threats. There were hit pieces on me, false allegations on Martin, on Sunetra, allegations of financial conflicts of interest. Like I, for instance, like an accusation that I was Koch funded. Mm. Not that there's anything wrong with someone being Koch funded, but I've never taken any money from the Koch Foundation, right? Most of my funding through my career has come from either from the NIH itself or, you know, it's funny for the head of the NIH calling a NIH-funded scientist fringe, but, you know, there it is, or from the FDA or from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid. You had essentially an abuse of power by the top scientific bureaucrats of the country to destroy the careers of people that oppose them on policy grounds. Mm. And it worked, right? It silenced scientists around the world who were afraid to speak up. And it led social media companies, often at the direct behest of the government, to censor discussion. Like, for instance, Google suppressed the link to the Great Barrington Declaration in the early days. People were sending me complaints saying, look, when we Google you, in Finland or wherever, you come up on page 3 and all these hit pieces ahead of you, right? The YouTube, Twitter, Reddit all censored discussion of the Great Barrington Declaration. It turns out that it was often at the behest of government requests directly to censor the discussion, because for governments that had adopted lockdowns, that were going to continue to adopt lockdowns and coercion strategies, they didn't want criticism. They didn't want valid experts actually criticizing them. And they used their power to censor that discussion.
This sort of touches really directly on the Twitter files, of which you were a very central part. Could you tell the story about how you found out that you had been included in the Twitter files?
Sure. I should go back just a little bit. So when we wrote the Great Barrington Declaration in October 2020, I didn't have a Twitter account. I had been telling my grad students for a decade that you shouldn't really join Twitter. It's more important that you write your scientific papers. That's how you make an impact on the world. Mm-hmm. To those grad students who are listening, I apologize. I was very, very wrong.
A time and a place.
Yeah, I mean, I just didn't understand the importance of public relations and the public communication of scientific facts. Mm-hmm. So after I wrote the Great Barrington Declaration in August of 2021, Martin Kulldorff, who I wrote it with, convinced me that I should join Twitter. Mm-hmm. He was very afraid that he himself was going to get censored. He'd already been suspended on Twitter for posting his idea. Remember, he's a vaccine safety specialist, works with the FDA and the CDC. He is a epidemiologist that works with the New York City Public Health. And Twitter had censored his account for his ideas about masking.
Wow.
Right. And so he was afraid that there wouldn't be if he was censored, it'd be more difficult to get the message of the Great Barrington Declaration out. So I joined Twitter in August of 2021. I very quickly got a lot of followers, I thought. I mean, 100,000 some followers very almost immediately. Mm. And then it plateaued and stopped. And I thought I was doing great. I mean, I didn't know anything about Twitter. I write something and like people would like it. And you know, you get the dopamine hit from people liking it. I get to say the things I want to say. I didn't see myself getting censored. Mm. But I joined Twitter in order to reach people that didn't agree with me. I mean, that's the whole purpose, really, for me joining Twitter. I don't really – it's fun to, like, talk to people that agree with you, but it's not the central reason. I didn't like – sometimes I get abuse, but mostly it would just be, you know, be people that agreed with me. When Elon – but there was always this sense, like, my message wasn't getting out as widely as it kind of ought to get out. I mean, here's this, like, major – pull of the lockdown debate, and you know, it's just relatively few people are seeing it, and almost everybody on my side is like, oh, Twitter censoring me. I'm like, okay, I don't know, I'm not sure for sure that that's true, but I could see my friends getting knocked off Twitter for saying things, and I also knew where the lines were, so I'm not going to cross. If I see my friends post something masked but in particular language, and I can see them getting booted off Twitter as a result of it. Mm-hmm. So I self-censored. I wouldn't cross that line because I didn't want to get censored. I didn't want to get explicitly censored.
Right. In
October 2022, Elon Musk says he's going to buy Twitter. He changes his mind, I guess, because he bids too much. But then a court forces him to go follow through, and he buys Twitter. And in December of 2022, he buys Twitter. Or November 2022, he buys Twitter. And Barry Weiss, who's a reporter for the Free Press, she's a friend of mine. Elon invites her to come see what the internal files are of the old Twitter management. Hmm. She does a search on me and finds out that Twitter had placed me on a blacklist. When I first joined Twitter, you know, I tried to get one of those blue check marks. I applied. Some friends of mine in various high places, they asked for me to get a blue check mark, and Twitter said no. It turns out, so Barry Weiss writes this piece. There's a picture of me from internal Twitter database with the word blacklist right next to me. Trends blacklist. The day I joined Twitter, Twitter had placed me on a blacklist so that every time I posted something, there was very little, my followers might see it, but there's almost no chance that people that weren't my followers would see it. Hmm. Right? That was the upshot of the trends blacklist. There were internal conversations about why I didn't get the blue check, that it turns out I wasn't notable enough. I mean, you know, whatever. I didn't really care about it. It's funny, right? So, like, the question is, why would Twitter 1.0 do this? Like, why would they put me on a blacklist? Why would they try to suppress my message, especially since they put me on the blacklist the day I joined Twitter?
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, the only thing I posted that day was the Great Barrington Declaration, really. One, then another op-ed that I posted.
Right.
And that's it. So the question is, why? Why would Twitter, what business interest is it of theirs to suppress speech, my speech? It was really interesting to watch this happen. So simultaneously with that, right around the time that Twitter was putting me on this, that Elon Musk bought Twitter, just I guess like in August 2022, the Missouri Attorney General's office reached out to me and told me that they were interested in filing a lawsuit against the Biden administration.
Wow.
And the allegation was that the Biden administration was putting pressure on social media companies to enact the censorship that I thought I was experiencing at Twitter. And it turns out I was experiencing at Twitter. The reason why they reached out to me in August 2022, I'd been a pro bono expert witness in a whole bunch of anti-lockdown, anti-mask mandate, anti-vaccine mandate cases, including with the Missouri Attorney General's office. So they thought of me when they put this lawsuit together against this free speech lawsuit, which eventually is called Missouri versus Biden. So I actually had considered like private action against Twitter, but I thought there's no way like one single person could.
Right.
And the other thing was like, you know, do these platforms have free speech rights themselves? Can they decide who to put on trans blacklists or not? I thought, well, you know, in some sense they're a private platform. Why mm-hmm. they should be able to do that, right? And so I thought, like, I didn't know what the legal basis for my suing them was. But when the Missouri Attorney General's office said that they were suing the Biden administration, well, there you have, I think, a really interesting case. If it's if the platforms are suppressing speech at the behest of the Biden administration, at the behest of the government, well, that violates the First Amendment.
Right.
And so that's why I agreed to join the lawsuit. I wrote an affidavit where I detailed a lot of the. I mean, there's a censorship of the Great Barrington Declaration. YouTube had censored a video of me talking to the sitting governor of Florida because I'd said something about children and masking.
Oh, wow.
And then of course there's the Twitter stuff that I suspected but didn't know. So that's that. It turns out from discovery in that lawsuit, it was the government.
Wow.
The federal government was censoring people at scale in social media. They would go to social media companies and tell the social media companies, you must censor these ideas.
Wow.
And then they would put them into like algorithms to identify posts that violated the line on, if you posted that there's good evidence that there's immunity after you're recovered from COVID, of that you have some immunity. Mm-hmm. Which all the literature is saying, really, you get it censored. If you've posted a vaccine injury, even a true vaccine injury, you get censored, right? The Biden administration told social media companies, these were the themes we want censored. And in some cases even, these are the people we want censored.
And the barefacedness of it is really kind of amazing to me that you would actually use the word blacklist, which has really like Orwellian Orwellian overtones, not even undertones. I mean, do you think it's also sort of shocking to me that that kind of evidence wouldn't be destroyed when you hand over Twitter to its new owner?
I think the problem is that that there was some sense that even though Musk had made this offer that he wasn't serious about it,
right.
And so it was a surprise when the court forced him to buy it. Mm-hmm. And the second, the amount of evidence is just so pervasive. It was like the center of Twitter's concerns.
Wow.
Their precedent state, like they would have to destroy all of the everything, because they like if you look at what actually they were talking about, they were often talking about, well, the government, the FBI told us that we have to take this down, the CDC says this is dangerous or whatever. They're discussing explicitly these demands from the government, they occasionally see them try to fight back.
Mm-hmm. But
Overarching all of it is this sense that if we don't do what the government does, the government will come after us. And you have Jen Psaki at the same time publicly saying and echoing President Biden that Facebook is killing people mm-hmm. by allowing open conversation about vaccine injury, right? The Surgeon General calling for people to snitch on misinformers. Right, that you know, we're calling for misinformation people to tell us about misinformation. I actually sent a letter into that call by the Surgeon General, basically with the allegation that the government was the number one source of misinformation during the
right.
pandemic.
Right.
I mean, what really was the case was that the government was using its censorship power in order to suppress criticism of government policy, something that should never happen in the United States.
The parallels to Cold War kind of Soviet policy are really striking. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit on if there are any kind of particularly salient elements of that stand out to you?
Sure. Well, so the word blacklist, you already pointed out,
right.
Annika, it's like the last time I heard that in American history was the House on American Activities Committee, right?
Right.
So like, you know, the McCarthy era blacklist of Hollywood celebrities that were that had some connection with the Communist Party, mm-hmm. right? So the use, I don't think the use of that word was accidental, right? The idea was that you needed to destroy the careers and reputations of anyone credible that opposed public health bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm.
And the justification was that if you had people who could legitimately argue with public health bureaucrats that had credentials, that would harm public health. That the very existence of a debate in public health would confuse people and lead them to take bad actions, wrong actions that didn't comply with the public health orders, because the public health orders themselves were extraordinary. Right. Just think about what we asked people to do. We asked people to not send their children to school for years. We asked people to not go to church or mosques or synagogues, not to practice their religious faith in person or in ways that they would normally do it. We told people to close their businesses. We told people to not go to their families' Thanksgivings and Christmases. We told people not to interact with their friends. We told children that they were dangerous to their grandmothers. We isolated old people in ways that, so that they couldn't see their family for a year or more. We told them that they should die alone. That you couldn't go to their funerals. We told people that you had to take these medical products whether you wanted them or not. Where people had questions. Even if you've already been injured with them, you have to take the next dose. We told people that if you didn't listen, then you weren't going to be allowed to go to school. You weren't going to be allowed to go to work. You weren't, and in many cases, you weren't even in many countries, you weren't even allowed to travel. That you were a pariah. The purpose of the thing was to isolate heretics. To essentially make to push them to the edge of society, and cleanse society, make it clean of the people that were threatening it, right? It's the same kind of idea that motivated the blacklists in the 1950s of the communists, right? Many of the people that were blacklisted in that era were just regular people. I mean, they have political ideas that I don't agree with, but they were just regular people with their political ideas. And they didn't need to be blacklisted. What they needed to be was reasoned with, argued with, right? The same thing I think is true of the kinds of people that were blacklisted in the COVID era. It's the same kind of problem, which is that a set of people think they're so bright and so smart that they can destroy the reputations and careers of and livelihoods and lives of people that disagree with them. It's the kind of thing that doesn't belong in American society, and yet we had it during the COVID era.
And I'm really happy that you pointed to the real human tragedy of locking old people away and preventing them from seeing their grandkids. It works. It's an interesting kind of parallel because you do direct Stanford Center for Democracy and Economics of Health and Aging. And I know this isn't exactly what they do, but it does strike me that there's not really enough discussion of what it actually would look like to respect human life quality, not just length. Because to me, I mean, dying with dignity includes dying surrounded by, your loved ones and your grandkids.
Yeah. I mean, I think just bare human life is not enough, right?
Yeah.
Like our policy should be focused on giving people fulfilled lives. And that it means human connection fundamentally. Even in the midst of a pandemic, it's incredibly important. I think the kind of policies that we might have followed had we been more humane to protect the older people would be, I'll just give you a few examples, right? So I argued for focused protection of vulnerable older people. Think about what happened in the early days of the pandemic where COVID-infected patients were sent to nursing homes. Spreading the disease exactly among the oldest, among the most vulnerable, by people like, Andrew Cuomo. The reason they did that wasn't because they're evil people, it's because of a mistaken idea. The idea was that the goal of policy should be to protect hospital systems. What if the goal of policy had been to protect vulnerable older people? Then no one would ever have thought of that.
Right.
Right, the orientation of policy was wrong, and so we didn't do it. Or why, for instance, in the early days of the pandemic, actually all through 2020 and into 2021, we didn't have at-home tests. That was a policy decision, right? It's not as if those at-home tests couldn't have been made in 2020. The technology existed. The problem was that public health wanted to know in real time every single positive case. And so they said, you have to go get a lab test, which was sometimes to take days. Because they wanted, the goal was test and trace.
Right.
Identify every person that has a positive case, isolate them, test and trace. instead of focused protection of vulnerable older people, right? So if you had rapid tests that you could have used in 2020, then before you go visit grandma, you test yourself. Public health doesn't need to know if you're positive, but you know, and so you won't go visit grandma, right? And it's because it's a rapid test, you know immediately, instead of waiting 3 days during which you might get COVID.
Right.
So the whole structure of decision-making, had it been oriented around focused protection of older people, would have been very, very different. The strategy instead was suppression of disease and using technologies that don't actually suppress the disease.
Wow. I actually had no idea that they didn't let people have at-home tests. That's crazy. We've kind of discussed the government element of it, and I'd definitely be remiss if I didn't also ask about the pharma element of it, because I think one of the things that's coming out as all this goes on is the extent to which kind of business and crony capitalism has been involved in the whole debacle. How has that, has that impacted, for instance, the lawsuit that you're currently undertaking at all?
So it hasn't impacted the lawsuit in ways that I can see anyways. But what has happened is that there's some reporting by Li Feng, who's a fantastic independent reporter, that I'm apparently on a Moderna hit list.
Wow.
If there are anyone who speaks about vaccines in a way that isn't worshipful, and I'm a big proponent of vaccines, but the fact is these vaccines don't stop you from getting COVID. That's just a fact from the scientific literature. Mm-hmm. So you say that publicly with some authority, and then you're going to be put on a Moderna hit list, and you got trolls saying, lies about you. Right?
How does that work to be on a Moderna hit list?
What he's found in internal documents is, here are the people that are spreading messages that are against our vaccine, mm-hmm. and then they will have a public thing where they say, okay, here's a message that Jay tweeted, and then their army of tens of thousands of influencers will then get on it.
Wow.
So they publicly defame people that are on their list. There's a long history of pharma doing this, right? So in there was a drug called Vioxx that Merck had once. Mm-hmm. Vioxx causes people to have strokes, that causes cardiovascular events that Merck knew about. Merck, it was a big drug. It was supposed to be a pain reliever that didn't cause stomach bleeding. And it was a big seller for them. And there were doctors that were publishing papers about the side effects. And Merck publicly defamed, went after and just tried to destroy the careers of the scientists that were blowing the whistle on them. So pharma has a history of this kind of psychopathic behavior. During the pandemic, let's just stay on the vaccines. It's mixed, actually. So you have governments like the Trump administration. They go to pharma and say, look, you have to drop everything, invest in this vaccine. That's actually an admirable thing, right? So you're in the middle of a pandemic. You want all of the best scientific minds. You want the industrial capacity of the big countries aimed at producing things that can save human life, right? So there's nothing wrong per se with that. There's also now the pharma demands as condition for this participation some protection against liability, because they're going to be cutting corners, right? They're going to be doing very, very rapid trials that normally would take years and years and years to do. In fact, in the early days of the pandemic, that's what I thought. It would take years to develop a vaccine. And they say, okay, we'll do this warp speed thing, but you have to give us protection. Again, that's completely understandable. Mm. So pharma then is engaged in the psychopathic kind of activities ex post, but with governments essentially allowing it, endorsing it, embracing it, it's really the nexus of private and public partnership on this that leads to pathologies that we've seen.
That is really, really interesting. I mean, so we've talked about government, tech, pharma. There's a fourth kind of major source of this that I'd like to put forward, universities. And you employed by a university as all of this has been going on. So you really do have kind of an inside view on how universities interact in this kind of ecosystem. What's been your experience of what role universities play in censorship?
Yeah, so let me just say, to begin with, I've been at Stanford since 1986. I was first a student and then a professor at Stanford, more or less continuously with a couple of years off. So I had nothing but the deepest love and respect for Stanford, even for colleagues of mine that I disagreed with. I thought it was a place where you could have those productive disagreements up until 2020.
Wow.
In 2020, Stanford acted in ways that completely violated its mission of academic freedom, mission of support for research. In response to research projects that I was doing in 2020, Stanford essentially made my life a living hell. The chair of medicine ordered me to stop talking to the press.
Wow.
There was essentially an attempt to silence me by Stanford. And to Stanford's credit, my tenure held, right? They didn't end up firing me, but if they could have, they would have. And there are many colleagues of mine at other universities who had tenure who weren't so lucky.
Wow.
So universities, by and large, with very, very few exceptions, did not do a good job in living up to their mission. Stanford, for instance, rather than protecting the ability for debate and discussion to happen around COVID policy, never held a COVID policy seminar through the whole course of the pandemic when it mattered. In fact, quite the opposite, it destroyed and demonized the careers of people that disagreed with the government's COVID policies. For instance, Scott Atlas, who's a colleague of mine at Stanford, the Faculty Senate of Stanford in 2020 voted to censure him. They used religious language. They said what he was doing was anathema to
wow.
the values of Stanford. Stanford has only censored three people in the history of the university, the faculty in the history of the university. And he had no due process rights. They just said he's a bad guy and then treated him like a witch.
Yeah.
I think during the pandemic, just from a positive point of view, failed to meet its obligation to promoting in a rational way debate and discussion. There were plenty of people that wanted the lockdowns at Stanford. Why didn't Stanford hold a policy forum where we could talk with them? They could have a discussion. The whole world would see it. They'd be interested to see what those arguments were. We would have won those arguments. The other thing that Stanford did during the pandemic, and still now to this day is doing, they are very closely connected with the censorship apparatus of the government. There's an entity called the Stanford Virality Project, which is supposedly a research project, but it's funded by the government. But what they really do is they launder the government's censorship activities, right? So in the House, the hearings that they've requisitioned emails and other evidence. What they found was that the leaders of the Stanford Virality Project explicitly understood that they were essentially representing the censorship demands of the government to the social media companies in ways that the social media companies would find much more attractive than if the government directly went to them. If the government directly tells them, censor this person, they're going to say, oh, no, we can't, this violates the First Amendment. But if Stanford Virality Project comes to them and says, oh, yeah, these are the kinds of people that are the central nodes of your misinformation network, then the social media companies listen. Mm-hmm. And it's the close links that Stanford has with the government that's really the problematic thing. This is not simply a research project that Stanford is doing and then they go and implement it. It's the government using Stanford as a cutout to implement censorship. If it was just a research project, then the research project's subjects, the Virality Project subjects, the researchers are violating the human subjects rights of those because the only aim of the Virality Project is to identify people that are supposedly misinforming and then suppress their free speech rights. So if you're a subject of the research, you're being harmed by it. Normally, research ethic boards would say you're not allowed to do that. So if it's simply a research project, then Stanford's violating research ethics. If it's not, but it's more than just a research project. It's Stanford serving as a intermediary of government censorship.
Wow. I'm a Stanford alum and I knew nothing about that. That's insane. It really strikes me that you say it's not just interfering with free speech, but it's also interfering with research itself. I mean, that strikes me as, at least very contrary to the way that they talk about it. Because I think that publicly, I mean, at least among students, not so much among university administration, but at least among students, there's, you know, debates. Do we actually want free speech? Is free speech good or not? But I don't think that we've gotten to a point where people would say, oh, is research good or not? So it's quite controversial that this would actually go so far as to impact research.
Well, I mean, I think there's a real chilling effect, right? So the way that the Great Barrington Declaration was treated made sure that scientists around the country said, I'm not going to stick my neck out. Right? Because they see the head of the NIH, he sits on top of almost $50 billion a year of research money. And if you don't get NIH funding in biomedicine, you don't have a research career. You don't get tenure. You don't climb up the research ladder. The sociology of the profession requires you to get NIH funding. You know, it's not just funding for the research itself, but the social standing you have within the scientific world depends on it. So you have the head of the NIH saying, these guys are fringe epidemiologists. These ideas deserve a devastating takedown. All of a sudden, even if you're a scientist that shares those ideas, you're not going to do a research project that has those implications. There are people who, in Denmark, they did this study of masks, an excellent randomized study of masks early in the pandemic in 2020. Randomized thousands of people, half of whom were encouraged to wear a mask, given masks, like a surgical mask, and half of whom were given nothing. And they compared what fraction of the patients, of the people that got the mask got COVID versus didn't, just a standard randomized trial. And they found that the mask had very little benefit. That was the result. The researchers themselves reported being unable to find editors of journals that would publish the paper.
Wow.
It took multiple efforts. And when they finally got an editor to publish the paper, it was the editor themselves faced tremendous pressure. Right? If they had the opposite result, it would have been published on the front page of the New York Times almost immediately. Right? So what you have is a situation where science is biased against what the government wants them to be biased against. And science can't function like that, right? That's closer to like Soviet era Lysenkoism, right? The famous biologist in the Soviet Union who thought that Mendelian genetics was a lie, and then sent Mendelian geneticists to Siberia, destroyed the careers of and silenced a tremendous number of very talented scientists in the Soviet Union. It's not quite that bad, but it's akin to that. You have essentially government saying you're not allowed to say this, you're not allowed to find this, and universities were supposed to be bulwarks against that kind of thinking. In fact, served that kind of thinking, worked to make sure that the scientists who disagreed with the public, what governments thought, their lives would be pressured, that they would be silenced, that their careers would be harmed if they spoke up.
So, starting to wrap this up, are there any rays of light or lessons that you think that we'll have learned coming out of the end of this? Do you think that coming out of this experience, especially given your lawsuit, do you think that there are issues that we'll have cleared up and we'll be able to move on productively with in the future?
I mean, I think we stand at a fork in the road. I don't know which direction we're going to take, Annika. I think that there is a increasing realization that what went on during the pandemic in the scientific community, in governments, and in social media, in pharma, there was something really deeply wrong with it. The public at large, I think, understands that they were sold a bill of goods. A lot of people have been harmed. Their careers have been harmed, of course. Their businesses closed. Their families harmed in ways, their children harmed in ways that are very difficult to recover. And so there's great uneasiness. The public trust in public health, in science, is at a low ebb as I've ever seen in my life. And so I think that's a fact about the world. At the same time, a lot of the people that made the decisions, these abusive decisions, they're still in power. They're still giving themselves awards. They're still pretending as if what they did was right. And the only problem was these fringe epidemiologists at the side that were criticizing them. I don't know which direction we'll head. I think if we are a good society, a responsible society, we will undertake an honest evaluation of what we've done. And I think any honest evaluation will conclude that our leaders failed us. Our scientific leaders failed us. Our government leaders failed us. University leaders failed us. And pharmaceutical companies, tech companies, they all failed us. And the question then is, what do you do about that fact? I mean, you can't get rid of everybody, and that would be non-productive. I think the situation is akin to when you have an airplane crash. right? You would do an honest evaluation of what's in the black box. You're not trying to point fingers. You're trying to like figure out what went wrong so it doesn't happen next time. Mm-hmm. If we are a responsible society, we will do that evaluation and let the chips fall where they may. Right. I think we will, and we will reform our system so that when there's another pandemic, we don't respond in the pathological way we responded to this one. But I don't know that that will happen. And I've been working toward trying to make that happen, that we do an honest evaluation. And I hope that's what we should decide, but there's no guarantee.
Jay, thank you so much for your time. I've learned so much in this conversation. This has been incredible.
Thank you, Annika.
Well, there you have it, Madisonians, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya on science and free speech. If you enjoyed this episode, first of all, like, comment, subscribe. We really appreciate it. Second of all, you can find out more about the James Madison Program and what we do here on Princeton's campus at jmp.princeton.edu. There, you can find our schedule of upcoming events. You can also find the recorded lectures from our previous events here on campus, including most recently, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya's. And you can sign up for our mailing list. You can also follow us on social media, on Twitter, at Madison Program, as well as on Instagram and Facebook. Again, thanks so much for tuning in, and I can't wait to see you next week here on Madison's Notes.